Colin Wilcox acknowledges the traditional custodians of the lands on which this podcast is recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and to all First Nations people joining us today.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode in our Building Better Boards and Leaders podcast, where we examine the key issues facing boards and executive leaders. I'm Susie Leese, Corporate and Commercial Partner and co-lead of our Beyond Compliance initiative and co-host of this podcast. Today we're going to look at boards behaving badly. What can go wrong and what are the key legal impacts and considerations when boards behave badly, and how do you manage through those issues? There's so much to unpack here, and certainly a range of behaviour that I see in practice as a lawyer and a corporate governance specialist, and also around the boardroom table as a director, from best practice corporate governance and excellent leadership in boardrooms to the imperfect but well-intentioned boards that perhaps played a little more risky, to the downright non-compliant and unacceptable board conduct that leads to board cleanouts and conflicts, and even corporate governance and regulatory reviews and potential reputational damage. To discuss these issues, I'm delighted to be joined by my colleague and fellow partner, Julian Hammond, who specialises in regulatory investigations and enforcement proceedings by bodies such as ASIC, APRA and the ATO. He is an anti-corruption and integrity specialist and has acted in 5 royal commissions as well as parliamentary inquiries. Welcome, Julian.
Thanks, Susie.
And we're also joined by Steve Knight, who is an experienced finance industry professional with previous senior executive roles, including UBS and ANZ, and as CEO of New South Wales Treasury Corporation. Steve is also an external member of the Hall & Wilcox board and has an impressive portfolio of non-executive board roles, including chair of ASX Clearing and Settlement Boards, roles with Australian Office of Financial Management and Housing Australia, to name just a few on your very long resume. Steve, it's great to have you here.
Thank you, Susie. It's great to be here.
So I think it's fair to say this is one of my favourite topics, and we all do a lot of work with boards. For me, conducting independent investigations on board misconduct, advising on and solving those board problems and issues, and on the more proactive side, I guess ensuring that boards have good governance frameworks and tools in place and helping support boards and company secretaries with their compliance obligations. And Julian, I know you do a lot in the litigious and regulatory investigation space. And Steve, I'm really excited to hear about your practical insights. So I think between the three of us, we could talk all day on this, and you both certainly have plenty of experience and anecdotes that we're going to share today.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks, Susie. I'm very excited to have a chat about this today.
So let's start with you, Julian. And I wanted to kick off with director liability, because there is an increasing amount of regulatory compliance, and certainly the risks of potential litigation is a real issue for boards and directors these days. There's, I would say, no shortage of headlines around board and executive misconduct, from the hasty exit of chairs and CEOs when things are not going so well, to white collar crime, which is probably more in your space than mine, personal liability under various legislation, to those regulator prosecutions, whether it's ASIC or the ACCC, and the list goes on. I'd love to know, what are you seeing as the key trends and risk issues when it comes to boards behaving badly?
Well, thanks, Susie. Yeah, look, one of the things I often think about in an organisation itself, but more particularly the board and sometimes the board's relationship with the CEO, is what I think we'd call the tournament of influence. And I think where boards are going wrong at the moment is, frankly, boardroom culture and dysfunctional boardroom culture. And what you're really seeing with some of these key trends playing out over the last few years, whether that's in a number of the casino inquiries where we've seen significant board cleanouts and liability, also some of the issues around destruction of historic Indigenous artefacts over the last few years as well, through to overseas examples, even thinking about OpenAI and Sam Altman recently, or even going back further to, you know, some of the board issues that cleaned out Steve Jobs back in the day. I think what you see in each of these examples is really dysfunctional group dynamics at a board level in that tournament of influence, and the way that is affecting the way a board communicates, analyzes problems, and also makes decisions. And that's occurring in an environment where boards are facing increasing scrutiny from all sides. As you say, the compliance demands on boards are extraordinary at the moment, whether that's in relation to legislation itself or more broadly across ESG pressures. And then thinking, you know, obviously over the last 6 to 12 to 18 months, geopolitical risk as well, and the way in which politics can be influencing the boardroom as well. So I think those are really some of the key trends. And if you have that dysfunctional group dynamic in a boardroom environment, what happens is that that tournament of influence probably results in individuals really, directing the way a board communicates, analyzes problems and makes decisions without allowing there to be that discussion, which is a product of the best boardroom culture and which utilizes the mix of great attributes that a great board will have. So I think if you look at those examples, whether some historic we talked about or some of the more recent ones that are making the headlines in the AFR every day at the moment, those are some of the key trends, but also some of the risk factors, I think, that are key at the moment for boards.
That's so true, Julian. And I really love that concept of the tournament of influence, because I think those power dynamics are always fascinating in any board. And you do see that groupthink, you see some power players perhaps have more influence, you see factions outside of boards, you see meetings before the meetings and then after the meetings, and the list goes on. I know my other degree is psychology, so I find the board dynamic piece a really important piece of the jigsaw puzzle when we talk about risk and compliance and boards and how they work together and how you get the best out of your boards as well, which we might talk about a bit more about later. Steve, I want to go to you next. From your perspective as someone who sits on various boards and I'm sure has seen a lot over the years of boards in action over the course of your career in the finance industry and beyond, what are some of the key issues or risks that you see keeping directors up at night?
Thanks, Lucy, and I'll cover that in a second, but it'll be interesting to come back and talk a little bit more about Julian's comments on the tournament of influence, because I think there's a lot to talk about there and a lot that I see, which I think we're going to come back to. In terms of those issues, I guess the old question, what keeps directors awake at night? And I think, a lot of it is going to be kind of industry or company specific. But I think if there are a couple of key themes, one of them is, I find from the boards that I've been involved in that a lot of it comes down to the degree of confidence the board has in the CEO. It's a trite old saying that the most important decisions that a board makes is hiring and firing a CEO. But it's not far from the truth, because essentially, you've got to consider what the boards are there to do and what the CEO is there to do. So if a board has confidence that the CEO is both capable, competent, and is also communicating well, then generally I'll find boards won't spend a lot of time lying awake at night worrying about operational matters. They'll worry about environment, external factors, other sort of things that could come and impact the company from left field. And I guess the common theme there and the thing that all boards I'm seeing spending a lot of time talking about, trying to get their heads around, is cyber risk and the various impacts of cyber risk. So, and this is, a case of having seen some of the high-profile problems that occur when a company is hit by a cyber attack, how they react to it. Once the players are in the media, they lose control of their own narrative. So a lot of boards are spending a lot of time not only really kind of kicking the tires and questioning across the organisation the degree to which their cyber threat security is as good as it can be, but also workshopping how they respond to a cyber event, what they do as a board, what management do. So a lot of, I think that's probably what I see at the moment, the most common top of board's minds in terms of the sort of risks, in addition to whatever their specific company or industry issues are.
Oh, I'd 100% agree with that. It's certainly something that we see in our privacy and our cybersecurity teams as well. We're dealing with some of those notifiable data breaches, and it's such an incredible crisis management type process and a risk issue that boards really have to be ahead of the game on. So completely agree with those comments. And I'm going to come back to the board and the CEO relationship in a minute, because I think that's a fascinating dynamic that we should talk about more for sure. Okay, so moving on to, I guess, some lessons for our listeners. I always find cases in this area and our practical experience in terms of learning the lessons of what not to do from other boards and directors can be really valuable. Can you give us some example, each of you, and I'll go to Julian first, no names, of course, on what you've seen, where directors get it wrong, perhaps in the media where directors or executives have behaved badly and paid that ultimate price, and what lessons can people take away from those case studies?
Look, thanks, Susie, for that question. Look, it's a really good question about when we see directors get it wrong. And I think some of the key examples over the last most recent period of time is that in these case studies, it is really an issue of the really setting a tone of a cultural framework. You know, the board and the chair are the custodians of the company. As Steve said earlier, you know, the most important choice that they will make is the hiring and firing of the CEO. But effectively, really what they are is the custodians of the company. And when we're advising companies, we talk a lot about the relationship with the general counsel, with the CEO, and again, that kind of tournament of influence there, as we talked about earlier. But where we see issues with boards is that boards sometimes make a mistake about the ethical tone and the boardroom culture that they themselves are setting. And there may be a desire not to hear bad news. I think there are some recent examples, particularly in the casino inquiries, which occurred across, you know, both New South Wales, Victoria, and of course WA as well. And there is a further casino inquiry occurring in New South Wales very shortly now as well. One of the key examples in that that I often talk about in an ethics presentation to lawyers is the fact that in one of the case studies there, the board did not receive any information about a secret kind of locked cage in one of these casinos where, you know, there was effectively money laundering going on, was the conclusion of one of the reports. And the board just never received any information about that. Now, that's a sign of, I think, that dysfunction that we talk about at the board level. And certainly in the example of that particular company, you know, there's been a board clean out. There is ongoing litigation by ASIC against the board and the general counsel there. But this is, you know, I think one of the key issues here is a board mistakes their role in some ways. You know, they need to understand as a board that you set the tone for an ethical culture in the company. And that is something which filters down to the CEO. And then obviously from the legal perspective, the relationship with the general counsel as well. But if there has been a tacit or implicit suggestion from the board that the board is not interested in particular information that might be suggest a compliance issue or concerns there, then you are going to expose yourself to significant risk. And as I said in that particular example there, which I think is a really potent example of almost a denial of an issue at the board level, or a refusal to accept that there is an issue, or refusal to be informed that there is an issue, that the directors have paid the ultimate price. There has been a board clean out and there is ongoing litigation against the individuals and the general counsel in relation to that particular entity. And it's a very potent example of exactly what can go wrong.
It's so fascinating, isn't it, when you think about the level of sticking your head in the sand almost in that sort of scenario. And I think, although that's an extreme example, the idea of, I don't want to know about that sort of behavior is something that is really scary, but also from the boards who do want to know and just can't get oversight or can't see behind the wall into the operations that management might be doing the wrong thing. But I guess you've got to have your senses about you, don't you, and to ask the right questions and to get more information and figure out how to balance that oversight perspective with the operational, which of course you don't want to get too involved in as a board director, but you do remain responsible. It's a real fine balancing act. And Steve, I'd love to hear from your perspective what you see are some of the examples that you've seen and how boards and directors can learn some lessons.
Yeah, thanks, Susie. And I think, you know, Julian makes a very good point in terms of, you know, a board having the key responsibility of setting that ethical tone for the organisation. Interesting, as you were talking about that, Julian, it sort of reminded me of something I've been reading just recently in a book that's called The Ethical Kaleidoscope, and it was written by a couple of, I think, Australian authors. So they cited a study that they did in not that long, so 2015, so not, well, a few years ago now, where they interviewed the chairs of a number of companies across Australia and New Zealand. So they were really trying to get a sense of how those chairs saw their ethical positioning and how they described it. And I said, interestingly, a large number of those chairs, they didn't say the majority, but it was a significant proportion, equated their ethical responsibility with their legal responsibility. So either they decided it's too hard to be fuzzy about ethics, so let's just say if we're acting legally, then that's our ethical starting point, or they had been influenced by other factors. But I was surprised when I read that, because I would have thought that, you know, a chair of a major company would want to have a set an ethical tone that was something greater than just meeting our legal obligations. But just moving on from that, and this is fascinating. I mean, there's so many case studies and so many examples. I often think about how to frame this because, and it's interesting in terms of even the topic of the topic of this podcast and the headline of boards behaving badly. And in my experience, I haven't really come across a board, thankfully, that goes out of its way to behave poorly or do things the wrong way.
It's often right. No one joins a board and says, "I want to be bad at this."
No, but it's also and it sort of implies a potentially a sinister agenda, which I think in very, very rarely happens. But what often happens with us there is that boards will, and it's a matter of really defining or delineating between what is a well-intentioned stuff-up, how the board reacts to that stuff-up, what might be sloppy governance, and then what ends up being, you know, dragging them down a poor decision-making framework, which can be seen as unethical behaviour. Because I think if I think of a number of case studies, and I guess some in the financial services that spring to mind, in each of these cases, these are just errors in the organisation, operational errors, which take their time to find their way up to the board. And by the time they're out there in the public arena, the test of the board's culture and their ethical lens isn't so much how did it happen, it's what are we going to do about it and how quickly do we respond to those issues? How quickly do we deal with the regulators? Do we try and minimise the issue, which I think sadly in too many high-profile cases, boards of major companies have tried to minimise the issue. I guess James Hardie historically is the classic in that example. And they end up being dragged down a road which paints them as being behaving badly or for making unethical decisions. So I guess if there is a sort of a learning for boards out of this, easier said than done, and hindsight is a wonderful thing. It's if an issue comes up, it's having that antenna to recognise early that it's going to be a significant issue and deal with it as quickly and openly and as transparently as you possibly can.
Yeah, that's some great advice, Steve. And it's certainly an interesting thing that when you were talking about the ethical perspective of directors and the idea of law and compliance equaling ethics, it just reminded me of the Royal Banking Commission and the whole concept from the Haynes final report of not can we, but should we, which I think is a fundamental question. And it's always fascinating that in these discussions on our Building Better Boards and Leaders podcast and our Beyond Compliance program, when we run training sessions, how often culture comes up as part of risk management, which is a key theme I can hear from both you and Julian, which is fantastic and a great lesson to be learned for all of our listeners. And I think that brings us to something that you touched on a little earlier and that pops up so often, and certainly I see it in organisations of all kinds across industries of all sizes, whether they're big corporates or not-for-profits, and it's that personality clash and board conflict, and also that real conflict or friction between board and management, those competing responsibilities or drivers, if you will. And I was thinking when you were talking about the head in the sand example, Julian, in the casino space, how often we see management want to give a gold star report to the board so that, you know, they're reporting to their bosses, right? That they want to put their best foot forward. And I think that's a really interesting relationship in how you manage that flow of information, how you set up an ethical culture, how you make it okay to bring things to a board's attention is a really interesting discussion from a good governance perspective, because we want to avoid that groupthink, right? And we want those different personalities and leadership styles, but that can be really difficult in practice, and you do have to often figure out how to deal with those difficult people and somehow discharge your director duties in good faith and so on, and in accordance with any board codes of conduct as well. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on what you've seen in terms of war stories or boards and executives behaving badly, or at least not in accordance with good governance principles, particularly around that chair and CEO role.
Yeah, again, look, I think some of the examples that we have talked about, including some very high profile international examples where you have that conflict between Sam Altman as the CEO of OpenAI and the board there, which ultimately resulted in Altman getting bundled off temporarily and then the board losing a few members and thanks to an investor revolt and then Altman coming back. You know, I think that these issues, as you say, they always come back to the board culture issue. And I think it's easy for us to sit here in the abstract and say, oh, you know, you've got to set an ethical tone and an ethical culture. It's hard to look yourself in the mirror and I think face the animal is the term that I use in relation to that. And I think that's really where I think for board culture and the relationship with the CEO and being able to interrogate properly what management is doing and ask the questions so you're not just getting the gold star report and giving it a tick, is really to get an independent expert advisor to look at the board culture and really give some conclusions as to whether it's functional or dysfunctional, what the relationship is with the CEO, and doing that as part of regular board reviews, looking at the patterns in your meeting behaviour and decision-making and communication, and really considering how that all filters into culture and performance. I mean, if we think of the OpenAI example from the reports that we've seen being a very high-profile company over the last 12 to 18 months, you know, what is clear is that there was a potent mismatch there between what the board saw as its role in terms of a custodian of, I think, altruistic AI versus what the management were undertaking as their tasks on the ground. And again, there was that sense that there was a clear disconnect there and there wasn't an understanding and there wasn't that alignment and mutuality between both the CEO and the board as to where they were going. That ultimately resulted in, as we said, Altman being dispensed with temporarily, an investor revolt because he's seen as the godfather of AI in some circles, and then being brought back with board members then themselves going after that. That is a clear example of where, you know, I think if a board was functional in those circumstances, it would be seen as, you know, there would be a clear dynamic between the board and the CEO, a collective pattern of thinking and communication, and an understanding of where the company should be heading on those critical issues, which are fundamental, I think, to the future of humanity in some ways as to how you use and develop and regulate AI. But obviously the disconnect was there, and it's a really clear, fascinating, high-profile example of that.
That was such a great example as well of something that played out really publicly, but also from a board perspective. I looked on at that and thought, what are they doing? It was a real example of what not to do almost.
Yeah,
And you know, knowing the difference, I suppose, is really important as to whether you've got someone who perhaps you've got a personality clash with versus someone who's actually a risk to the company, because they're two different things, right? And we talk about there's board conflict and then there's conflicts of interest, like they're different, yes, different they issues, and one are behavioral and the other is risk-based. So I think I'll come to my next question, which is, how do you deal with those sort of people and how do you manage through these issues? But Steve, I want to go to you first, because I know you started us off as well with a comment about that key relationship between the chair and the CEO and board dynamics being so important and culture in the boardroom.
Yep, absolutely. No, thanks, Lizzie. Someone made a comment to me a while ago, and I can't remember who it was, but they likened a board to a family in an outing in a car, where you've got the CEO in the driver's seat, you've got the chair in the passenger seat giving some directions here and there, and you've got the rest of the non-executive directors in the back seat. They're the kids going, are we there yet? And that's probably a little bit unfair.
That's excellent.
Non-exec directors. But it's
pretty accurate, perhaps, in some cases.
But it sort of paints a picture. And where it resonated with me was that it really does kind of highlight that critical relationship is between the chair and the CEO. And it's not that the other directors are.
But if it crashes, you all crash, right?
Correct. That's right. So, you know, and I've seen this, I've lived this, I've seen what good looks like, I've seen what not so good looks like. But firstly, you know, it is, you know, and it's probably trite to say it, but if there is a very good, strong, honest relationship between the chair and the CEO, then it makes life so much easier, both for the rest of the board and also for the rest of management. If that trust isn't there, then you increase the likelihood that the board's only going to get the good news story, that the messages are going to be filtered. And I reflected on this from my time when I was a CEO, and I was very fortunate that I had a good relationship with my board, and one where I felt there was no inhibitor and there was an encouragement for me to bring, you know, the old adage, bring good news quickly, bring bad news even quicker. So I'd be very open in letting them know the good, the bad and the ugly of what was going on in the organisation. And that was always met with the right sort of response. There was challenge, you know, there was questioning, but there was support for that approach. So I lived that and experienced what that was like and how it felt as a CEO to have that confidence that you did have the backing of the board, that you could actually tell them things weren't going so well and they work constructively with you to try and work through the issues that you were dealing with. Then seeing that from the other side of the fence as a non-exec director, you know, that dynamic is so important. And it's not just about the directors themselves trusting each other, and everybody brings different skills, perspectives to the table. So there needs to be an environment where all directors are encouraged to challenge and put their views forward without, you know, the squeakiest wheels getting the most of the time. And I think it's equally important for the directors to feel there's that environment, but also more importantly, for there to be that relationship with management, not just the CEO, but for the senior leaders who are presenting to the boards and preparing the board papers that really form the basis of the discussion, that they feel that there is that sort of culture of confidence that they can tell the full story and not sugarcoat it. In some companies, that takes a lot of time to develop. Often it requires a sort of a change of CEO or a change of board members or a clean out if that has gone off the rails and isn't happening effectively.
That relationship and that balance, I think, is so important. And the transparency piece you mentioned, I think that's actually really rare. And I know a lot of my CEO clients, their biggest bugbear is, oh, the board's always at me and, you know, they won't let me just get on with the job. But at the same time, it gives such, from the other side of the fence, it gives boards and directors so much comfort when they have a CEO who is transparent and will tell them the good, the bad, the ugly, because you get comfort from that no one's hiding anything. But you've got to, I think, create that culture where you don't have a blame game every time something comes to you, such that your executives and your CEOs feel like their head's on the chopping block. But accountability still has to be there as well.
No, that's right, Susie. And it also, a lot of that, and that does, a lot of that resides with the chair then, to make sure that he or she is encouraging that. But also when, you know, if there is bad news being brought to the board, and it is natural for, you know, that, you know, some directors will go down a questioning or critical line, and that's fine. But the chair then has to bring that back to being something that ends up being a constructive conversation and one which leads to improvements in the organisation and doesn't scare the CEO or senior management away from, you know, being that transparent in the future.
And we know things are going to go wrong, you know, as directors and, you know, people in executive roles. So it's really how you deal with that and how you stop it from happening again or mitigate the damage from the risk that has arisen that I think is so important. Okay, finally wrapping up, and we've had so much great discussion today and so many fantastic themes that have come out of this. What advice would you give directors or even the C-suite as to how best to manage these sorts of boards behaving badly type issues, which do often become crisis management? I know from my perspective, I always go back to basics and start from those duties and obligations, a bit of a good governance lens. Interested in your thoughts. Julian, I might go to you first.
Yeah, thanks, Susie. I agree with that. I think it is almost going back to, you know, that initial starting point of duties and obligations, a good governance lens, getting a sense of, you know, what the responsibility is for the board so that there isn't an opportunity to perpetuate the functional behaviour that we have talked about today, and then conducting regular training reviews to understand how directors work together, how they treat each other, how they relate to management. All those types of things are really about ensuring that you minimise the opportunity for dysfunction to creep into that culture and that you're really continually shaping and reshaping the way a board will set priorities, make decisions and manage risk. And I think those are the key kind of issues and advice that I would give directors is that this is something which is not set in stone. It needs to be continually trained and retrained across the board to make sure that, you know, you are on top of, you know, the increasing level of oversight, regulatory change, technology, as Steve talked about with cyber as well, and that you're drawing on the full range of views and experience of a board and also examining your own culture. You know, whether you're actually proactively tapping into the wealth of expertise and experience on the board and whether you're asking the right questions. So I think those are the key tips and advice that I would give.
That's some great advice there, Julie. And I 100% agree. Asking the right questions can be key, particularly, I know I've seen board reports where they're all gold star reports and you're kind of getting all greens on the KPIs repeatedly every month. And you have to ask yourself, what am I not being told and what's not in there? Steve, what about you? What are your key tips for managing through these types of issues?
Yeah, thanks, Julie. I think one of the things that strikes me, a lot of what we've talked about today, quite rightly, is the dynamic of boards and how they can respond and deal with issues and problems when they arise. And really that's what makes or breaks a company often in terms of how they deal with their issues and crises. And you know, we've seen plenty of examples of where that's been done badly. And then you go down ethical rabbit holes and the rest. But something that strikes me and something that I've been thinking about for quite some time is what can boards do to reduce the likelihood of those issues coming up, you know, the old prevention being better than cure verdict. And one of the things that I've sort of seen happen both through management and in board work is I really wonder whether boards do enough time to question when things are going well, why they're going well, rather than focusing on the issues that are being dealt with that they feel need correction. And quite often, and maybe this kind of speaks to my background, you know, having come through as a trader in financial markets through the 80s and 90s, but plenty of examples of rogue trader behaviour and other things where organisations are very, very happy to just see the profits growing until something went wrong, and then everyone sort of scrambles and goes, well, why didn't we see this sooner? And a historical case study, it's an old one but a good one, which brings to mind is the old AWA case I'm showing my age here, but this happened back in the 80s and ended up being a landmark case on directors and officers' responsibilities and director duties. But essentially AWA, which was a kind of a smallish Australian company making wirelesses, had a 24-year-old employee who was running their treasury function and just trading foreign exchange and ended up being the biggest corporate foreign exchange client trading Australian dollars against other currencies in the marketplace and reportedly making all these wonderful profits until it was discovered that, the bad trades were being hidden and not being reported and ended up being significant losses for the organisation. And nobody questioned when things were going well why a company like AWA was trading so actively in foreign exchange. So management and the boards were just happy to accept the profits. And that's one example, but we've seen many, many other examples where organisations perhaps aren't asking enough tough questions when a particular line of business or perhaps even a novel line of business for an entity, if it's continuing to grow and provide or contribute significant profits, perhaps if there's a little bit more forensic analysis of what's going on there. Having said this, it's really hard for boards to do because, you know, they're always conscious of the fact that they're questioning management, grilling them and asking them for more information on the issues that need remediation. And I think it's difficult for directors to really play the Grinch and say, yeah, you say this is going really well, but why is it going well? But I do think there is a common thread there that in many of the cases where things have gone horribly off the rails for companies, it's because something that was seemingly going well for a long period of time was being sugarcoated.
Such an important point. And I think we do often see that where boards are so busy fighting fires because they're the biggest or the loudest or the noisiest risk issue in front of them that they perhaps don't get to prioritise the strategic risks that they should be looking at, and to your point, asking the right questions and having that inquiring mind, and not just in the bad stuff, but also, well, why is that doing so well? There's a bit of an outlier there. I think that's a fantastic tip, and probably goes to that head in the sand point that Julian made earlier. We really do have to be across the activities of the organisation when we sit on these board roles, which is fantastic insights from you both today, and thank you so much for your time. I think, you know, I know there's so much to talk about here, and I'm sure our listeners will take away lots of lessons from this discussion. Thank you everyone for listening today. As always, please get in touch with us if you have any questions. You can find our details on our website, which is hallandwilcox.com.au, or connect with us on LinkedIn. If you enjoyed today's episode, then rate, review, or follow our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
This podcast is not legal advice and should not be relied upon as such. You should always obtain legal advice about your specific circumstances.